The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening to the what we're calling the Monster.com edition of this Friday Takeaway. Some employment advice from the show here. You can make a lot of money doing work for the government. That's right. The trick is not actually working for the government like elected officials do, with low salaries set by frustrated voters and subject to being voted out of office. Elective office can be thankless compared to being a contractor. On this Friday, government jobs that can make you very rich and that at least in one case can get you killed or in serious trouble. At the end of the hour, the Bechtel Corporation that has moved mountains and rivers, connected Britain and France under the English Channel, but its secrecy is as legendary as all the concrete it has moved during its existence. That's later this hour. But we begin with an even more secret corporation among the hundreds of military contractors who flooded into the Middle East after 9/11 to profit off the sudden infusion of Pentagon cash into the region. Eric Prince, then the founder of the mercenary firm Blackwater, was one of them. A billionaire's son who joined the U.S. Navy SEALs on his own accord and then made himself a sort of indispensable piece in the American War on Terror. The Blackwater brand got a little tarnished from its overreaching armed paramilitaries, and when in 2004, four of the company's contractors were attacked, their corpses mutilated and dragged through the Iraqi city of Fallujah, Americans watched in horror from their television sets at home.
We're going to begin with Iraq this evening. Four American civilians were killed there today, and as sometimes happens, the cameras were there for the gruesome aftermath. The four men were part of a very large contingent of heavily armed Americans who are everywhere in Iraq these days, some of them working for the government, including the CIA, others providing security in some form or another to the American occupation. They were attacked and killed in the city of Fallujah. And there was no other city in Iraq where Americans are quite so unpopular.
Eventually, Blackwater ditched its name after those bloody events and some costly litigation before being acquired by a group of private investors in 2010. But Eric Prince continued what he saw as his mission, to profit and win in the war on terror.
Prince represents what is, in the darkest corners of Washington, actually official policy. We can do what we want around the world, and we don't have to answer questions from pesky lawmakers or journalists or lawyers. And so what's amazing is Eric Prince's ability to just keep going and to keep finding more business opportunities.
That's reporter Jeremy Scahill, investigative journalist and co-founder of The Intercept, who alongside Intercept investigative journalist Matthew Cole reported this week that in the midst of those new business opportunities, Eric Prince now may find himself under investigation by the Department of Justice for attempting to broker military services to foreign governments, including China, and for possible money laundering, all while functioning as the chairman of his latest venture, Frontier Services Group. Many of The Intercept sources in their reporting, including current and former business partners of Eric Prince, who still has the power to intimidate, apparently, four former U.S. intelligence officers and others familiar with the DOJ investigation, have chosen to remain anonymous.
Eric Prince is this guy who portrays himself as an uber patriot, Captain America. And when America sort of abandons him, in his view, and Blackwater faces litigation and investigations and everything, he runs around the world trying to find another sponsor and now ends up with people with very close connections to the Chinese Communist Party. And he is running a company that is servicing Chinese interests in Africa. And at the same time, he's running all of these other programs behind the backs of the corporate executives at this publicly traded company called Frontier Services Group. So, it's an old line of work, being a soldier of fortune. But the kind of turnabout here with Eric Prince going from, very close to Dick Cheney, I'm Captain America, to all of a sudden jumping in bed with people with very serious connections to Chinese intelligence is quite a story.
I'd also add that the one thing that makes it unique, but Eric Prince in particular in Blackwater, is that prior to 9/11, this wasn't an American industry. So while that's true that you've had mercenaries forever, they were largely relegated to people who came from colonies. And it was a colonial thing in Africa and Asia, the French Foreign Legion. This Eric Prince represents the post 9/11 American entry into this market. And from the standpoint of branding and access, I'd say he's number one or number two in the world in terms of success.
Is it the case that Prince is under investigation for money laundering, illegal ties to the Chinese, and illegal brokering of mercenary services?
Well, it's our understanding that the Department of Justice has an investigation looking into brokering military services, which includes and encompasses a lot of things. Can be sales, can be trafficking, can be just the brokering, which is walking into a room and suggesting to country leader X that he buy a force or weapons from provider Z. That led to surveillance on Mr. Prince, and in the surveillance, they picked him up discussing the attempt to open up a bank account on behalf of some Libyans, and then later learned that he was in China trying to open up an account, met with Chinese intelligence, and subsequently did open up an account. So certainly the investigation is currently expansive in terms of the number of things they're looking at. It's unclear what they have in terms of how close they may or may not be to an indictment. According to Mr. Prince's lawyers, neither Mr. Prince nor his lawyers have been informed that he is a subject of an investigation.
Is it illegal for him to be working for the Chinese?
Well, no. I mean, it's not unless he is providing the Chinese with defense services or goods. And there's a very serious question about whether his activities constitute defense services or goods. What's interesting is there's a whole division of the State Department that monitors and these kinds of activities and issues licenses to be able to do these things. Whether Eric Prince has the licenses to do this right now is an open question if it does cross the line into something that would be against U.S. law.
He's got a very powerful lawyer, Victoria Tenzing, who's on retainer or involved in a specific prosecution, as far as you can tell.
Well, Eric Prince, goes through lawyers like a kid goes through Cheetos. I mean, it's hard to know who he's being represented by at any given moment. She's obviously a very a political lawyer, is on Fox News regularly talking about the Benghazi stuff. And in fact, when Matthew and I first talked to her, she's like, the Justice Department is investigating Eric Prince. I thought they were supposed to be investigating Hillary's emails and 150 agents running around chasing after the Hillary story. But look, the lawyer that Prince would need to deal with some of these allegations is someone that is a true expert on defense export regulations, not a political lawyer. I mean, we were kind of astonished that he made her available to speak to us on the record. The story sort of changed as we talked to her over the days. When we first told her what we were going to report, she acted like we had just landed from Mars. Then we started to tell her more and more of the evidence that we had, and she started to give different answers. At first it was like, what are you talking about? He wouldn't need to do anything in Macau. Next thing we know, she says, yes, he did open a bank account at Bank of China, but it was for a company. Okay, well, what company was it for? I'm not going to tell you what company it was for. Did it have anything to do with Libyans? What are you talking about? Then the next day, well, I'm going to have to see. I mean, it's clear that they now realize they're going to have to take this seriously, because this isn't just some blog post that someone threw up on the web. There are files, some of which we published, that when we analyze them have metadata showing that Eric Prince and his colleagues drafted, edited, and circulated these proposals. This is not, some conspiracy theory. This is serious, and I think that Prince is now realizing that.
What is the CITIC Group?
CITIC Group is the official investment arm of the Chinese government, and they own roughly 20% or more, possibly, of Frontier Services Group, which is the company that Eric is the chairman on. They're a legitimate corporation and investment group, but they act on behalf of Chinese central government.
And remember, Frontier Services Group is a publicly traded company on the Hong Kong Exchange. This company is not a mercenary company. It's not a security company. In fact, they have an explicit ban on doing business that the U.S. would consider defense export. The issue here is that Eric Prince, as the chairman of this public company, is using his legitimacy to set up meetings with the president of Nigeria, factions in Libya, a number of other countries in Africa, and he's going there as the chair of a legitimate company, but the services he's offering are not services that company offers. Those are services he wants to provide through a network of shell companies that he and his little cohort of private CIA guys that they want to do business with.
In Africa, the Chinese are involved in acquiring natural resources and protecting natural resources. In the Pacific, the Chinese are involved in disputing territory in the waters in the South China Sea. Based on your reporting, is there any likelihood that Prince's activities might come face to face with U.S. military interests, either in Africa or the Pacific?
You know, that's unclear. I mean, one of the things that gets confusing about Mr. Prince is that in addition to Frontier Services Group, for which he's the chairman, he has another entity, which is a private investment firm called Frontier Resources. And Frontier Resources did a lot more investing in Africa, to our understanding, specifically in mining and natural resources. So it's not so much that he would come face-to-face with U.S. interests or against it, but rather he is financially staked and aligned with some Chinese investment, whether it's official government investment or through CITIC Group. We haven't seen anything that indicates his involvement in the Pacific area, though that doesn't mean it's not so.
Well, another part of what you're asking, though, is, I mean, there's a whole other scenario that it's not exactly what you were saying, John, but it could cause serious problems for the U.S. military or intelligence. If you look at what happened with Blackwater in Iraq, their forces acted like they were sort of the kingpins of the war zone, that they were more important than the commanders of the uniformed U.S. military. They would go into, you know, a village or a place where they felt that there was a threat, and they would spray and pray, as they called it. I mean, they opened fire and killed a lot of people, and that caused blowback on U.S. soldiers. When four of their guys went into the center of Fallujah in March of 2004 and ended up getting killed, you know, dismembered, and then hung from a bridge, those guys were in an area that the U.S. military wouldn't even go into. That then sparked a massive uprising that united the Shia forces of Muqtada al-Sadr with the more nationalist Sunni forces in western Iraq. Blackwater was at the center of multiple firefights that inflamed the situation on the ground in Iraq. So if Eric Prince is running some sort of a mercenary force in Libya or in Nigeria, and he believes that what we're doing is we want to wipe out Boko Haram, or we're going to, you know, stop the growing, you know, radical Islamic presence in Libya, and his guys end up killing a bunch of civilians, who are the people going to come and attack? They're not going to say, oh, well, we better find Eric Prince's guys to go and kill. No, all Americans are viewed as the occupation at that point. So that's what happened in Iraq, and I think it's not that Eric would be necessarily on the opposite side of the U.S. It's that his actions would end up causing blowback and the deaths of U.S. soldiers or other diplomatic personnel.
Jeremy Scahill and Matthew Cole, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Matthew Cole and Jeremy Scahill are investigative journalists for The Intercept. Scahill is co-founder of the online news publication. Eric Prince's lawyer described their reporting as, quote, total BS. As Europe was torn apart by war 100 years ago, a rebellion on the Monday after Easter started a revolution that would change the British Isles forever. 1,600 Irish rebels took over public buildings in Dublin, and they used the General Post Office as their headquarters, where one of the leaders, Patrick Pearse, declared an Irish Republic. Irish men and Irish women, the Irish Republic is entitled to and hereby claims the allegiance of every Irishman and Irishwoman. The Republic guarantees religious and civil liberty, equal rights, and equal opportunities to all of its citizens. The rebels fought the British Army for 6 days, but eventually surrendered, outgunned and outmanned, and for a long time the details of that surrender were erased. A woman named Elizabeth O'Farrell negotiated the end of the fighting, but her face was lost to history. Today, Ireland looks back to the contradiction, some with mixed feelings about celebrating a violent uprising. The history of the women who participated in the Easter Rising is also being remembered. This is thanks to the research of people like Dr. Mary McAuliffe, a lecturer in women's studies at University College in Dublin. Professor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
So I gather this revolution that is not well remembered, even a century later, that was so critical, is not a Braveheart kind of thing. It's filled with energy, but not the kind of masculine energy we associate with, the Scottish Rebellion or even later on various 20th century rebellions. It was almost hidden by World War I.
Well, it does happen in the middle of World War One, and it is a small rebellion for all sorts of reasons. It only happened in Dublin and one or two other places in Ireland. So it's less than 1,500 people, including about 300 women who participate in this rebellion. But despite that, it is the foundation of the state. It's the beginning of the breaking of the link with Britain for Ireland at this time. And despite the fact that it only goes on for a week and about 400 people are killed on the streets of Dublin. When you compare that to 5,000 dying in one day on the Western Front, it does seem a very small occurrence in the middle of a great war.
It's important to think back 100 years of the importance of women as symbols, as martyrs, and as revolutionary leaders. I mean, there's Elizabeth O'Farrell in Ireland, but there are also very powerful women who helped to spur the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, and who maintained the sort of literary voice of revolutionary Russia as poets. Women were important all across the continent. Tell me a little bit about Elizabeth O'Farrell.
Well, Elizabeth O'Farrell is a member of the women's organization who are nationalist. It's Cumann na mBan. It's Irish for basically organization of women, set up in 1914 to provide a platform from which Irish women could express their nationalism and their feminism. They are inspired by all those political ideologies that are happening, not just in Ireland, but in America, in Russia, throughout Europe. Feminism, the fight for the right to vote, the rise of trade unionism and the rights of workers. Elizabeth O'Farrell would have been in the Irish Women Workers Union. And nationalism and the rise of the idea of the nation state. So Elizabeth joins all of these organizations, as do so many of the other women. And it's a young generation, a generation that have rejected the kind of more moderate politics of the previous generation. They want to do something, and they want to do it very quickly, and they're quite willing to be militant about it, whether it's breaking windows as feminists, and going on hunger strike if they're imprisoned, or getting involved in a violent revolution. And many of them use culture as well. It's interesting that a number of the female revolutionaries are Abbey actresses, the Abbey Theatre being the national theatre set up by W.B. Yeats. Quite a number of them leave the Abbey stage and get involved in, I suppose, another performance, which is The Easter Rising.
Would you say that the sexual revolution that took place at the turn of the century, where all sorts of Victorian secrets about sexuality were coming very much to the surface, was a part of this revolution and emboldened women to find their own identities within this revolution?
Well, I certainly think it's part of it. You see, with the women, this young generation of women, a lot of them are making choices about who they choose to marry, which was an unusual thing in Irish society, indeed, in most Western societies at the time. Your parents really had an input on who you made a match with. And it was within your class, and things like that mattered. But you see this young generation making their own choices. And you also have some of the women certainly make choices about living with other women and making their lives with, they refer to them as lifelong friend, dear companion, all that sort of thing. But what they're doing is they're creating families and households with these female partners, and they remain with them politically and personally for all of their lives. So you do see more radical choices being made around all sorts of things, politically and personally, in this period.
Dr. Mary McAuliffe is a lecturer in women's studies at University College in Dublin, celebrating, remembering, thinking about the Good Friday Agreement and the centenary of the Easter Rising moment that began the Irish independence movement. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Depending on where your radio is tuned to these days, you might think that Ted Cruz has the GOP nomination all locked up.
People who listen to this program know exactly where I'm coming from. It should be no surprise to them that I have, after watching all these candidates and drawing my own conclusions and openly explaining where I'm coming from, what I'm thinking, what who and who is saying what, that I would endorse Ted Cruz.
As you probably know, over the weekend I endorsed Ted Cruz for president of the United States, the first Hispanic president, the first generation American president, and the most conservative president since Ronald Reagan.
Glenn Beck and Mark Levin, those are the radio talk show hosts who have endorsed Ted Cruz. And then there's Pope Rush himself.
If conservatism is your bag, if conservatism is the dominating factor in how you vote, there is no other choice for you in this campaign than Ted Cruz.
Although Limbaugh hasn't endorsed Ted Cruz, but he has signaled his support, and you can hear it right there. Donald Trump leads with white, less educated, lower income men who are skeptical of the Princeton and Harvard educated Cruz, apparently. Here's Vinny in Long Island calling into the Rush Limbaugh show.
And Cruz, you know, unfortunately for him, I liked him in the beginning. I mean, I really loved him.
Well, then what happened?
The political vice president. What happened? I'll tell you what happened.
What happened if you liked him and he hadn't changed any? What happened?
I'll give you a great explanation why probably 90% of Trump supporters now hate him. Because he took out the long lawyer knives on Trump.
Well, Daryl Parks has spent his career decoding and working in talk radio as a talk show host and executive. He's now a media critic. You can find his work at darylparks.com. Daryl, the long lawyer knives on Trump?
That's a good one. I haven't heard that before.
So let's just talk, generally speaking, about the influence of Glenn Beck and his soundtrack and Mark Levin and his kind of angry certainty that you hear on his show all the time. And then, of course, Rush. You know, a decade ago, these were the guys. These were Laura Ingraham. These were the folks. What do you make of them today?
The influence of conservative talk radio is overstated. And to your point, I made my career in this for a couple of decades, and program talk stations, was a talk show host. But one of the things that I never did, and the radio stations I programmed, we never took ourselves seriously. We never forgot about the entertainment factor of talk radio. And what happened a number of years ago, and I really can't put a finger to this and when it happened, but I have my theories, that all of a sudden talk radio became serious. It became, you know, my job as a host is to change one person's mind from either being a moderate or a liberal to conservative. And that whole entertainment factor left talk radio. But what ends up happening is, I think more on a local level with talk show hosts, what ends up happening is all of a sudden the local politicos and the local politicians start making calls to you and say, hey, look, you're great. We listen to you all the time. Hey, could I come on your radio show? And all of a sudden the local talk show hosts think that they have some perceived power and that they are all of a sudden the champions of a cause. Where talk radio is really missing the boat today is talk radio is focusing on a core audience that, as I write a lot on my blog at darylparks.com, is focused on about a 65-year-old angry white guy. And that is a group of people that is shrinking daily. And when you look at the future of talk radio or you look at the future of media, it's not hard to figure out how or where media needs to go. And it's with millennials. Millennials now, by number, are the biggest population group in this country. But at the interesting thing is 10,000 baby boomers are retiring every day. And when you look at the millennials and you look at their beliefs, their belief system, when it comes to same-sex marriage versus, for instance, baby boomers, same-sex marriage accepted in society, 64% of millennials feel that way. 45% of baby boomers feel that way. As far as immigration, 57% of millennials feel that immigrants will strengthen our country and our economy, where only 39% think of baby boomers think that way.
And Daryl, millennials think that radios are toaster ovens.
Oh, yeah. I just came across some research that came out not too long ago. Edison Research put out a, it's called the Infinidial. They do it every year. And it was looking at millennials and how many millennials don't have radios in their house. Just a few years ago, that number was in the single digits. This year, in 2016, it was 21%.
There's a formula to get that 65-year-old angry guy. And O'Reilly did it. Rush does it. Levin does it. It's all about, they think you're dumb, but you're not dumb. You're smart. And let me tell you, here's how you fight those people that are telling you that you're dumb. And you know, they sort of empower these older people to be angry. You can't do that with millennials because they're thinking that they're not ignored. They're cool. Mm-hmm. So what is the formula, the discourse formula to get to them?
Simple. Speak in their language. Address things. Reflect things that they're concerned about. If you're listening to talk radio and the host is against something like same-sex marriage, they are totally disconnected from the future and the survival of talk radio.
And you got to know who the personnel are in One Direction.
Yes, you do.
Daryl Park spent his career working in talk radio as a talk show host and executive. He's now a media critic, and you can find his work at darylparks.com. Thanks, Daryl.
Thank you, John.
Today, our excited civic officials can be found at shopping mall ribbon cuttings around the country, making the most of an event that pales in significance to the public projects from quite another era.
Let's go shopping!
And so Boulder Dam stands today, stemming and controlling the floods and bending the will of the Colorado River to perform the fruitful tasks of a civilization rapidly invading the limits of its last frontier.
The era of the grand constructions in America, the Grand Coulee Dam, the Golden Gate Bridge, the George Washington Bridge, the unearthly Boulder Dam, now called the Hoover Dam. You can barely imagine things like this being built in our time. The Hoover Dam supplies water for Los Angeles, Las Vegas, and everything in between. Actually, the people who can still imagine building such things are doing it today. The folks at the giant Bechtel Corporation built the Hoover Dam in partnership with six private companies. A symbiotic public-private relationship that has come to define modern-day America. It also made the folks at Bechtel into billionaires. A new book by Sally Denton, The Profiteers, Bechtel and the Men Who Built the World, looks at a company that is the face of America in the 21st century, representing its shareholders rather than the face of American democracy.
Having grown up in the West and seeing Bechtel as the first major Western mega company that really built, you know, the American West, which is what I thought the book would be about when I started the research 4 years ago, I was shocked at how it's a household name in the American West, and most of America has never heard of it. Everybody I told, you know, the 30-second elevator pitch about the book I was writing, everybody would say, who? But then if you go to the Middle East or to Europe or practically any other continent in the world, it is a household name.
How did the company get started, and where did the family come from?
The company really got started with Warren Bechtel, who was originally from Pennsylvania, but he was a road grader across Oklahoma into northern Nevada and then to California, and got the first government contract to build a major highway in northern California. So it really starts with government contracts, but the signature project was Hoover Dam. There's this great mythology that has arisen around the dam being an FDR project at the height of the Depression to put America's unemployed to work, when in fact it was very much a Herbert Hoover design and creation as a boon to his fellow California industrialists and big agriculture and real estate developers, and as the first major private-public partnership of its kind in America. But basically, this was such a massive engineering feat that there was not one particular company in the entire American West capable of handling it on its own. So they teamed together and then just took off from there into defense contracting and the build-up to World War II and through the Cold War and into nuclear energy, into oil pipelines, into ports. I mean, it's hard to find a place in the world or a type of project that Bechtel has not built.
I mean, anyone in San Francisco can point out the Transamerica Pyramid, the old Transamerica Pyramid building, or the Embarcadero,
Bay Bridge, BART,
or the Golden Gate. And if you want to drive from Britain to France, you go through Bechtel.
They built the channel. It's hard to even keep up with them, but if you just go to the website, it's hard to know for sure how many airports. But Abu Dhabi and Dubai and Qatar and McCarran here in Las Vegas, and they just did the Silver Line from Dulles, the metro there in Washington, D.C. I was shocked to find that it had not only stayed in construction, but had expanded into nuclear power and oil pipelines throughout the Middle East, throughout the entire world. It was the largest producer of nuclear energy of any company in the world. Got the largest single first contract for the reconstruction of Iraq after our invasion of Iraq. And just they're always there in anything that's happening.
How much are they worth? Any guesses?
Well, like everything with them, you have to take them at face value. They, you know, they've got, I don't know how many billions of dollars of contracts under currently for, say, the year 2015. I think that Riley and Stephen Bechtel Sr. or Jr. are both, according to Forbes, I think worth the same amount, maybe $37 billion, which is in the land of billionaires. That's not really that much. They're worth a lot less than a lot of other billionaires, but they wield a lot more political influence than companies and individuals worth much, much, much more.
You described the revolving door between government and Bechtel. You know, as the names accumulate, it's really quite extraordinary, but again, not necessarily illegal at all.
No, I don't think there's anything illegal about this, but, you know, I argue in my book that Bechtel really formulated the pattern of the revolving door back in the 40s and 50s, which then became its pro forma. Nobody even, you know, people barely even notice it anymore. I focus some, not entirely, but I focus a lot of attention to the Reagan era because of the Reagan Revolution, which really signified the movement of the American West into an economic and political power center. And Bechtel was really symbolic of that, as Reagan plucked two executives from Bechtel, George Shultz as Secretary of State and Caspar Weinberger as Secretary of Defense. So it really put Bechtel on the map. But Bechtel had been mining government from the days of the Atomic Energy Commission. Every company in America does it now to such an extent that there's actually, you know, rules for a cooling off period.
The history of the relationship between government and corporations is a strange one in the United States. I mean, in the beginning, there was extreme suspicion of corporations, and chartering corporations was something the government did at its own whim, and they could rescind those charters without even a reason. And then I think during the progressive period of Teddy Roosevelt's, corporations got a bad rap for being too big, too powerful. Now it seems we're on the other side, that, you know, there's an admiration that goes with companies the size of Bechtel, and almost an admiration for the secrecy, that if you don't have to report, wow, you're really powerful.
Mean, I think it's an enviable position that its rivals, I think, truly do envy. One of the things that really struck me when I started out, I kept thinking, because of the symbiotic relationship between Bechtel and the U.S. government and American foreign policy through several decades, when I started, I thought, well, here's Bechtel, who's kind of, you know, the corporate arm of U.S. government. And by the end of my research and writing, I felt like oftentimes U.S. government was the public policy arm of Bechtel, that in many ways Bechtel was larger than the U.S. government.
Sally Denton is the author of The Profiteers, Bechtel and the Men Who Built the World. Thanks so much, Sally.
Thank you.
Play it once, sir. For old time's sake.
Hoo-ah!
I didn't get a harump out of that guy.
Did you say... wait? Wait.
Hey, what happened?
Woody Allen's one movie about wheat, yes, and Russian literature at the same time, only he could put those two together. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, welcome.
Hi, John.
It's Friday, time to talk movies, and of course the big one is Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, with Ben Affleck playing Superman. And who's Batman here?
Ben Affleck is Batman.
Ben Affleck is Batman,
and
that's
Henry,
right.
Henry Cavill is Superman.
That's right. So everyone wants Superman to win because of the whole Jennifer Garner thing. So emotionally, everyone's...
That's right. Everyone's been rooting against Ben Affleck back since they announced his casting as Batman in the first place. That was 2013, I think.
So with that backstory, let's hear a clip.
What's your position, the Bat Vigilante in Gotham? Daily Planet. Do I own this one, or is that the other guy? Civil liberties are being trampled on in your city. Good people living in fear. Don't believe everything you hear, son.
Now, this extrapolates quite a lot about the chemistry of these two together here.
Well,
from the comics.
What you have is the sort of odd situation of Clark Kent accusing Batman of being a vigilante with no oversight. And Batman, of course, thinks that Superman is the exact same thing. So you have this sort of odd battle between, I would say, sort of pot and kettle, basically, fighting each other. I don't really think it works, and I'm going to raise an objection. Why are Metropolis and Gotham suddenly kind of two different cities across a harbor? I always thought those two cities were mutually exclusive versions of New York City. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Don't quite get that. And there's a
Budapest.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And it doesn't work. I think there's a lot of nonsensical plot holes in this film. And the whole Batman versus Superman kind of title card bout is really just wheel spinning until we get to an entirely different other unrelated climax, which I promised Warner Brothers I would not spoil for my readers. So there you go.
A franchise that jumps the shark with two sharks in this particular case.
But there's more to come. Justice League.
Oh, yeah, no kidding. Speaking of franchise possibilities, I'm kind of surprised that My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 didn't get made a decade ago. Here's a clip.
You all want to do this?
Of course we do!
Thank you. Thank you so much. Maybe everyone could pick a category. Food, glassware.
The wedding is on! Pick a category, report to me. I'm in charge.
Actually, Thea, you're not.
Yes, it's best. No, it's what everyone wants, dear.
Now, the mom is back. Right.
Yeah, pretty much everyone is back. Lainey Kazan, that's Andrea Martin, right. As her aunt. Nia Vardal is apparently, of course, is back. John Corbett, who plays Ian. So you have the whole principal cast is here. I think the problem is when you've got a movie called My Big Fat Greek Wedding and you want to have My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, you're really going to start reaching for where's that wedding coming from. And so in this case, it comes from her parents who find out that their old world marriage certificate is incomplete. And so they want to have their own wedding. But of course, mom refuses unless the dad will repropose and he's too stubborn. And that's the kind of material you have here. And it's pretty thin. And it just doesn't have that great organic natural feel that the first one did.
Maybe it should have been My Big Fat Ukrainian Wedding. Just move on to a different ethnicity.
Something.
Perhaps, yeah. But is it the case that My Big Fat Greek Wedding is the most profitable film of all time, something like that?
I guess, I mean, it was a massive, massive hit. I think that film cost something like $10 million or maybe even $5 million, and it made 300 something at the box office. It was the Rocky of its day, you know. It was this sort of one-woman juggernaut, and it was great. I loved that film. It doesn't work here. The material just isn't there.
Eye in the Sky, what do you think of this?
This is the big drone warfare drama. Helen Mirren, Alan Rickman, posthumous role for him.
Right.
He's great in it. Great cast. Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad. What you basically have is a classical ethical dilemma. There's a terrorist bunker with some suicide bombers in it preparing to go out and blow up something or someone. And there's a little girl standing in the way. Do we bomb that bunker and blow up the little girl, or do we spare her life? That's the dilemma here.
Is it relevant, the morality of the drones here? Does it work, or is it more just a spy action film?
I found it really just kind of a very sentimental exercise in ethics, and I didn't think it illuminated anything about drone warfare for me.
The unethical Rafer Guzman, who prefers immorality to morality, film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, John. You too.